This habit of categorizing and judging our experiences locks us into automatic reactions that we are not even aware of and that often have no objective basis at all. These judgments tend to dominate our minds, making it difficult for us even to find any peace within ourselves or to develop any discernment as to what may actually be going on inwardly or outwardly.
Welcome to Thriveology Lab Podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbeck, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Phil, where can folks find us?
Everywhere. We are on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we will respond. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn, as well as send questions or comments to thriveologylab@gmail.com.
For today's topic, we have an interview with a friend and colleague of both of ours, Dr. Susan Prill. Susan Prill came to Juniata's faculty in 2006 as an assistant professor of religion, specializing in world religions. She previously worked as a postdoctoral fellow at Hamilton College in Clinton, New York. She was promoted to associate professor in 2012 and professor in 2018. Dr. Prill's main area of teaching is world religions, with a particular focus on religions originating in India and religious environmentalism. She has taught courses on yoga and yogic philosophies, goddesses, religion and ecology, American religions, and Islam. Her current research concerns sacred gardens and the relationships between people and land in central Pennsylvania.
Dr. Prill earned a bachelor's degree in religion in 1996 from Bard College and went on to earn a master's in South Asian studies in 2000 from University of Michigan. She earned her doctoral degree in 2005 from the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London.
Dr. Prill's publications include multiple entries for Hinduism in 5 minutes, Equinox 2022, Eco-Theology in the Sikh World, Rutledge 2024, Sustainable Sikh Approaches to Environmentalism in Sikh Formation's Special Book Edition 2015, Sikhi, am I saying that right?
Yeah. Sikhi,
okay. Through Internet Film and Videos in the Oxford Handbook of Sikh Studies, Oxford 2014, excerpt Accept the True Name, I Have No Miracle, Modern Sikh Understandings of the Miraculous in Sikhism in Global Context, Oxford 2011, Representing Sainthood in Indiana, Sikh and Hindu Visions of Namdev in Material Religions, 2009.
Indiana.
Huh? What'd I say? Did I say Indiana?
Yeah.
That's my Hoosier coming out.
I'm sure there are saints in Indiana.
Well, I also don't have my glasses on. That's another problem.
Dr. Prill is a member of the American Academy of Religion and has been certified to teach meditation by Blue Throat Yoga and the Mindfulness Institute for Emerging Adults, and is all around just a really good person and friend. The opening quote we started with was from Jon Kabat-Zinn's book, Folk Catastrophe Living, and I'll just repeat that real quick here. This habit of categorizing and judging our experience locks us into automatic reactions that we are not even aware of, and that often have no objective basis at all. These judgments tend to dominate our minds, making it difficult for us to find any peace within ourselves or to develop any discernment as to what may actually be going on inwardly or outwardly. Now, Jon Kabat-Zinn is, of course, famous for kind of bringing mindfulness kind of into the Western medical circles in particular. And I think a good place to start might be, where does mindfulness fit into, you know, that's kind of almost everyone's reference in terms of meditation, but it is just one tradition out of a very broad range. So can you help place that in the context for us?
I will do my very best.
Okay.
Hello. So Jon Kabat-Zinn, as I was saying, his roots are in Buddhism. He was a very serious Buddhist practitioner for many years. And mindfulness combines some Buddhist techniques that would have been initially taught to people in monasteries with with yogic practices and practices borrowed from a variety of other techniques. So what we call mindfulness is a combination of techniques that work on focus and techniques that work on sort of continual awareness of thoughts without interference. So really what mindfulness is depends on who's teaching mindfulness and what techniques they're using. I would also say that mindfulness, the way I would differentiate mindfulness from meditation more broadly, is that there are types of mindfulness that are very much sort of using waking awareness. So you can mindfully wash the dishes or mindfully walk to work. Whereas what we call meditation is mostly silent, seated practice. So
you and I were talking about the challenges of defining what is and what is not meditation.
Yeah, and it gets I mean, I think this is true whenever you define any term that is a high-stakes kind of term, yeah. Right? Yeah. So what I call meditation and what somebody else calls meditation might be different. And it's really important to note that if you take five different practitioners from five different paths and they're all seated and they're all silent and they're all eyes closed, very, very different things could be happening inside of each person based on those techniques. So they might be focusing on something like a mantra, a sacred syllable, a visualization. They might be bringing attention to their breath or to some part of their body. They might be envisioning light moving up and down the body. Any number of things might be happening internally, and it's, of course, hard to tell what's happening inside the brain unless you hook people up to various machines.
And certainly bringing up sort of Jon Kabat-Zinn, sort of his mindfulness-based stress reduction, and often students come often to mindfulness or meditative practice for one of those reasons, and you were saying earlier that was sort of how you came. Could you just... How did you come to a mindfulness practice or a meditation practice?
So I would say there's sort of four benchmarks for that for me. When I was in high school, I started doing yoga for stress reduction, and yoga was at that point not the multi-billion dollar industry that it is today. It was very much homegrown.
You weren't buying all the yoga clothes.
I was not. We practiced. They didn't have mats. So this is 1990. We didn't have yoga mats. We practiced on carpet samples. For grip when you have your hands down on the ground, you need some grip. It was literally carpet squares that they had gotten from some carpet company. That's great. And it worked great. You know, and I just showed up in sweatpants and a t-shirt and we just did it and it was great. And it really did help with my stress reduction. And then I did a little bit of yoga in college, but not very seriously. And then in 1996, I started practicing meditation through a group called Siddha Yoga. And that was mostly mantra-based, focus-based meditation. And then that was my practice for, I would say, at least 5 years, and then it sort of subsided. There were some changes in the organization, and a variety of sort of dramas occurred. And I also moved a lot of times in that time period, and it was sort of disruptive to my regularity of practice. And then I'd been teaching yoga history for since about 2005. And every time I taught it, I would say, "Ugh, I really need to get back to practicing." And so in 20, 2014. No, sorry. Yeah, in 2014, I spent a week at a Zen retreat. Actually, the building was a Zen retreat. The practice was what's called Vipassana, which is continuing awareness. And then also in 2014, I adopted what is my most recent very serious practice, which was a form of meditation called Nilakanta meditation taught by Blue Throat Yoga. And that is a mantra-based practice. It's a cousin of transcendental meditation. And that I practiced very seriously for about, I would say, 9 years, twice a day, every day, almost without fail. And then, again, I moved and there was some disruption. And so right now I don't have a very regular practice. I've been doing some visualization practices and some breathing awareness, but I haven't been back to my regularity of practice.
So the mantra-based, I mean, I'm guessing people have some idea of what that is, mm-hmm. but you just describe it as there's some mantra that you're repeating, mm-hmm. perhaps even silently,
yeah.
as a point of focus.
Yeah.
I might say similarly, you can say yes or no to in some of the mindfulness tradition, you're focused on your breath.
Right.
Rather than the breath being the anchor, it's this mantra.
So, there's basically two approaches to mantra.
Yeah.
One of them, which is, I would say, what Siddha Yoga practiced, was basically sometimes you chant the mantra, sometimes you recite it inwardly, and then you just keep repeating it inwardly. And if you notice that you're not doing it, then you go back to it. And it's sort of a continual practice. So it's sort of constantly going on in your mind. You're walking around, you're doing it, you're seated, you're doing it. It's sort of all-encompassing Swiss Army knife mantra. Blue Throat Yoga teaches, from my understanding, this is very similar to transcendental meditation. Each individual is given a particular mantra through a ritual process, and that is, I would say, it's a sort of softer hold on the mantra. The mantra we talked about it melts, it sort of dissolves, becomes formless in the mind, and then when your mind starts to sort of drift into thoughts and so forth. That's understood in a positive sense in Blue Throat Yoga. It's as a sort of inward cleaning kind of process. But once it gets too agitated, then you again reintroduce the mantra. But there's a lot more sort of I always think of it sort of like a sine wave. You start with your mantra, and then you sort of drop in, and it's very, very quiet. And then at some point, you know, the brain starts doing what the brain does, and you get, you know, laundry lists and that person who I didn't like in eighth grade and all the things. And then once you notice that that's happening, then you again come back to the mantra.
Well, I think it's probably true for most people if you don't have the benefit of actually living at a monastery. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that sort of the micro and macro that in a practice, the mind drifts and, you know, you have to constantly bring it back. But even as you're talking, and I think it's true for both Phil and I, like in our daily lives, the practice itself drifts away. We have to bring it back and right. It drifts away and we have to bring it back. So it's like this internal, external representation yeah. of how the practice is life.
Yeah. I like to think of it as seasons.
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes it's summer and it's really easy. And
yeah.
Right now I'm kind of in winter, but yeah, the I think the attitude to thought is really very, very different in different mm-hmm. forms of meditation. And the other thing you mentioned that I wanted to pick up on is the difference between practicing meditation as a monk versus practicing it as a person with loved ones and a job and, you know, sort of average human responsibilities, right? If you're in a monastery, somebody else is taking care of your food and your job is to meditate, and to a very significant degree, sort of minimize your individuality. Whereas as a what we call a householder in the yogic tradition, your job is not to minimize your individuality. It's to grow into your own autonomy and your best creative self. So I would say that the meditation is going to work differently in those two spaces because the person is needing to do something very different. And the critique within at least sort of yoga-based traditions of mindfulness is that a lot of these are they're techniques that are taught for monastic purposes that are now being used by householders without any awareness of some of the pitfalls of, for example, I guess separating yourself too far from your thoughts.
Could you say more about that? Like what?
So I'm trying to think of a way to do it without a lot of vocabulary. The way to think about it is, and this is from the yogic tradition, so take it in that context. The understanding going back about 1,000 years in India is that there's basically a cosmic ocean of consciousness, and each of us is like an individual wave on that ocean. And there's basically two approaches to that. One is you want to sort of minimize your waviness and become more oceanic. And another is that you want the wave to sort of rise up almost like a tsunami and encompass the entire ocean inside of it. And so it's an expansion of individuality rather than a diminishing of individuality. So Maharishi Mahesh Yogi used to say, people would say, you know, I'm meditating so that I can defeat my ego. And he would say, the problem with your ego isn't that it's too big, it's that it's too small and it's not encompassing the entire world. So take that for what it is. But yeah, it's a different attitude towards things. So what sometimes happens for especially people who are doing some monastic style practices is that they start to feel disconnected from family and job and so forth. And that's partially because some of these mental techniques are used to do that in a monastic setting where you want that to be happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes sense, right? So like thinking about where some of these traditions came mm-hmm. out of, if the goal is enlightenment and transcending the physical mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. that's very different than how I use it today, which is really to engage more fully
right.
with my present world.
Right.
And I guess you're, you know, saying that more closely related to what would be called the householder
yeah.
tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm very familiar with that from Taoism, the mm-hmm. distrust of language, right? That the Tao that can be named is not the true Tao, kind right. of, you know, that classic.
Yeah.
That as soon as you start to use language, you're putting labels on things that artificially box experiences mm-hmm. and at least part of how I see my practice is trying to let go of some of those labels a little bit, because what do they stop you from seeing or stop you from right. experiencing? And you can think of stereotypes even as, yeah. you know, as examples of that.
And so that's becoming aware of your own thought patterns and, yeah. and how that can be limiting. I will say, like in the Buddhist tradition, there's a differentiation between some of the techniques taught in Southeast Asia, which is where Jon Kabat-Zinn, his training comes from, and some of the techniques taught in places like China and Japan, without going into a whole religious studies lecture, those forms of Buddhism are what we call Mahayana and are much more focused on householder life. Whereas the traditions from places like Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma are much more focused on monastic practice.
Can I go off on a tangent a little bit?
Of course, yes.
I'm still sort of hung up on the sort of the paradox of that ocean imagery for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
And that goes back, I think, to your language thing too. Like, it what I hear is that we are simultaneously the ocean and the wave, mm-hmm. right. and trying to reconcile that linguistically is hard because as soon as I say I'm this, well, then I'm not that, mm-hmm. And it's that Tao, like I can't, it's hard to explain what I feel like I want, my spirit wants to gravitate to, but then I can't talk about it. Like, how do you reconcile some of those paradoxes, or like how, softball question.
Ask me an easy question, why don't you? I mean, you guys surf, so you're the ocean experts from my point of view, but I mean, waves have their individual characteristics, right? And yet if you, you know, if you miss one and you land in it, it all tastes the same. So I guess that's where I would go. It's, you know, some waves are big, some big waves are small, some waves are dangerous. Mm. But what is, yeah, I mean, at some level, it's asking what is the self-awareness of the wave, which I want to say it's a metaphor. Don't stretch it too far.
So one of the things I've talked a little bit about is how, and I think you've alluded to it in our conversation here, how the modern practice is both connected with the tradition and detached from it.
Right.
And I think of, for example, some of the mindfulness programs and apps, Headspace, and others, which obviously use a lot of mindfulness concepts from Buddhism mm-hmm. in some form, but might not actually reference any of it explicitly, mm-hmm. which I find interesting. And I think, you know, my guess is it's a way to make it secular yeah. and more accessible. And, you know, and to the extent that it is good for people's health and well-being, I think that's a good thing. But then also what is lost in that tradition as well when you're not, you know, you know, yoga similarly in terms of, you know, it is a nice practice in terms of flexibility and relaxation and Tai Chi as well, right? And, yeah. and all these things as they become popular mm-hmm. and they take on their kind of modern form. So
things are gained and things are lost.
Things are gained and things are lost.
Right. Yeah. I would say specifically about mindfulness and how it talks and doesn't talk about its roots. Mm-hmm. I think I have mixed feelings about it. At a certain level, if you say to somebody, this is a Buddhist practice, that can be a barrier to a practice that might otherwise be very beneficial because they'll say, well, I'm not a Buddhist, mm-hmm. right? I'm a Christian or I'm a Jew or mm-hmm. I'm an atheist. Why would I want to practice this? And so in that sense, it's a barrier. And I'm from a Buddhist point of view, it depends what teacher you're talking to, what their feelings are on this. So Thich Nhat Hanh from the Vietnamese Zen tradition has basically said, mindfulness is for everybody, don't worry about that stuff. But you do get critiques from within, especially the American Buddhist community, saying, well, one of the important things about Buddhism is ethics. What does it mean for you to be practicing you know, this practice that largely comes from Buddhism without any attention whatsoever to ethics. And people, of course, get heated about those sorts of things. I would say, from my point of view, it matters a little bit what practice you're talking about. Many, many cultures have some variation of I'm going to repeat a phrase or a syllable or something internally. There's the Jesus prayer in Jesuit practice and in Orthodox practice. There's Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism all have some variation of that. In Islam, you recite the 99 names of God. So there's some variation of that in virtually every religion that I can think of. The rosary in Catholicism.
Yeah. The ethics part is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I think of martial arts traditions, and if you're just teaching the striking and kicking and you're not teaching any martial morality,
right.
Well, there's a big gap there.
Right.
And that's basically like the storyline of every kung fu movie.
Right.
There's essentially a student going astray on their moral code.
Karate Kid.
Kung Fu Panda, Karate Kid, Cobra Kai,
right.
All of that.
I would say mostly mindfulness is not out to harm, but some of the particular aspects of what I'm going to call modern mindfulness culture that American Buddhists have objected to include Silicon Valley adopting mindfulness practices for productivity purposes and in some cases constructing meditation spaces so that people can take breaks during their extremely long work days. To be basically better workers for the company without regard to is this the best interest of the employee to have, excessively long work day? Is it in the best interest of the employee to have, again, no ethical guidance on how to apply their productivity? The military has also use some mindfulness practices. And depending on your school of Buddhism, this is or is not a problem. I mean, if we look at the Zen practice of Japan, that was the practice of the samurai. Mm-hmm. So in that context, there's no problem. There's no contradiction between meditation and military activity. But some of the traditions from Southeast Asia – very much they separate military and monastic. And if you think the most important thing about your Buddhist ethics is nonviolence, and then the military says, here, I'm going to train you to be a better sniper by using breath awareness.
There's a tension there.
There's a tension there. On the other hand, I mean, there's always another hand, right? And if you're going to be a sniper – is it in everybody's best interest that you hit your target and not some random bystander? Is it in your best interest that maybe you don't develop PTSD from that? I would say yes. So at what point do the ethics get applied? Is a tricky situation.
Well, I think that what I hear is sort of two and 2.5 things coming out of that as well. What these practices invite us to do is that sort of contemplative reflection on where do I stand on this? Mm-hmm. Not because there's an objectively right answer, but there's your answer in line with your values and your beliefs and where you're looking at any given moment per se. But like, I think that these practices invite that reflection. But for somebody who's listening, who's like, I haven't started yet, sometimes just starting anywhere might be the thing. And then what I was going to say, my 2.5 is like, I think it's true, and we probably ought to do a whole episode on just the benefit of a teacher, of like having a coach, a teacher, of like finding the person that you're like, this is the person that's going to help lead me down the path that I've chosen, even though there might be an infinite number of paths that I could have chosen.
Right. Yeah. Sometimes. I think a teacher is very important. Now, if you have never ever meditated in your entire life, do you absolutely need a teacher on day one? I would say not necessarily. There's a number of great YouTube videos and apps and things that sort of can get you started. As much as I've been trying to complicate all of this, like the benefits of meditation, virtually any kind of meditation has benefits in terms of focus, in terms of increased sort of equanimity, sort of even temperedness, in terms of stress reduction, in terms of blood pressure and all that kind of stuff. And so you don't necessarily have to stress about that early on. It's just, okay, what is a practice that works for me? And quite a number of the apps and, you know, honestly, if you just YouTube, like, I want to do a 15-minute meditation, I think you'll probably find something decent. And then you play with it because there's at least 10 techniques that are really commonly taught and accessible. So maybe what works for you is breath awareness. Maybe what works for you is visualization. Maybe what works for you is body scans, you know, all these sorts of things. Play with it, find what works, and then maybe go for a teacher. And again, back to the seasons thing, right? Different teachers may be the right teacher for you at different times of your life.
When I was even thinking that, I was thinking about that as you were saying, like, even the practice may change. Like, I might need a more sort of text-based anchor. Mm-hmm. Maybe I just want some open awareness. Maybe mm-hmm. I need this and this time. Right, yeah.
And as your practice matures, right, your experience will change. So I think sometimes I think there's two barriers to regular practice for people who want to practice. One is language around religion, right? It's Buddhist, it's Hindu, whatever. And I really think that that shouldn't necessarily be a barrier. And the other is that you hear these stories about these just extraordinary meditation experiences. You know, I closed my eyes and I was just in ecstasy for 3 hours and I came down and everything was glowing and, you know, and like, that's wonderful. It is not a fair expectation that that's going to happen for you the first day you sit down and meditate. Like, maybe you are an extremely blessed person. That is how it's going to go for you. But
More likely that it doesn't go very well. And you think, I'm no good at this. It's not for me because I can't stay focused. Yeah.
So I would say give it at least a couple of months. And then don't measure it by your experience while meditating. Measure it by your experience while not meditating. How is my daily life different? Because I think sometimes our mind just isn't clocking what's happening internally during meditation practice. And so you can sit for meditation and it can feel like, ugh, I'm so stressed and I'm so distractible and what's wrong with me? You know, all of those self-judgy thoughts that we sometimes have. But then you get up from your mat and you're like, oh, wow, I'm not as mad about that thing as I was before. So something has shifted, but it's similar to, like, I guess anything that you practice for self-care. If you take a bubble bath, the goal is not just to have a nice bubble bath. It's that when you get out of that bubble bath, things seem better, right?
Yeah, I go for a massage, not just because it feels good in an hour. But because I'm less tense for the next couple of weeks, actually.
And so think of meditation like that as something in your tool chest to shift your daily experience, the rest of your life. Because otherwise, what, like, sitting silently for 20 minutes is maybe not, like, why would you do that if the sole goal was just to sit silently?
Well, that's a part what I like about – that's very explicit in mindfulness. And Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about this. And, you know, if you're going to wash the dishes, wash the dishes.
Right.
And that it is – in a way, it is when you are sitting, at least, you know, that you're practicing being present so that you can then be more present in everything else you do.
Right.
And this is, and you and I talked about this earlier too, this difference between meditation as a way of being more present versus meditation as a way toward enlightenment that is transcending the physical world. Mm-hmm. And versus enlightenment is awakening to now, which I see in the Zen and the Taoists. so If you were to categorize kind of different approaches being more in that, like, so what would be an example of one that is this? I mean, I grew up Catholic, and for me that was very much like, when you die, you don't want to burn in hell, therefore you should do these things. And I know there's obviously a lot more to it. But as a child, that was a lot of what I, you know, it seemed so much of it. Now, at the same time, the Gospels were very, to me, seemed very much about now, about how to live peacefully with other people today, right? And
we don't want a straw man Catholicism.
No, we don't. Growing up, I saw both of those, right? Growing up in the Catholic Church. And I see that in Buddhist traditions as well, and I'm sure other meditation traditions.
Yeah. There's a tension between what I would call otherworldly versus this worldly, or transcendent versus immanent focuses. Most people practicing mindfulness for well-being purposes are not aiming for anything that I would categorize as enlightenment.
Yeah.
Now, I have been in this field for, let's see, I got my PhD 20 years ago. I'm still not sure that I could define for you clearly what enlightenment is. I think it's one of those, if you're there, you know, kind of situations. But most people who are practicing meditation for stress reduction are not aiming to merge with the absolute or see the face of God or whatever as their primary goal for meditation. And so I'm also of two minds of this. It's like, well, you know, if you have a technique that practices that promises you, you know, permanently altered sense of self and experience of transcendence, and then you say, well, I'm doing it for my blood pressure, it seems like you're not utilizing it. It's like, you know, you own a Bugatti and you never go above 5 miles an hour. It's like you're not using it to its best advantage. And yet, there's also the question of accessibility and you know, if you have a hammer, you can use it for a lot of different things. And sometimes you just need to hang a picture, and sometimes you need to build a barn. It's still the same hammer. I know there's different kinds of hammers, but you know what I mean? Like, it's still the same basic technique, but it's being used in a very different context.
So let's talk about yoga as an example in that, right? Because you're teaching a class, co-teaching with Jen Strepp on yoga, and of course, long Indian philosophical spiritual tradition.
Right.
How has that transformed into kind of what we consider yoga today? And roughly, what's the timeline?
How long do you have?
5 minutes.
The word yoga in India is a roughly 2,000-year-old term, and originally it just means discipline. It's like when you it's related to the English word yoke, like when you yoke oxen together just to allow them to be steered. In that same way, yoga is a path or a self-discipline. Up until, I'm going to give you like 2,000 years of history in 3 minutes.
good.
So starting in about the year 400, they start to talk about what's called asana, which is posture. But it's really, it literally just says sit comfortably. Take a seat that is comfortable and stable.
It's not down dog and up dog.
It is not down dog. It is definitely not any arm balances or anything like that. And round by the year about 1,000, we have developed a series of postures that are mostly, it's one of two things. One is preparation for seated meditation. So if you're going to be in seated meditation for a long time, it helps if your hips don't seize up and your knees feel okay and you have blood flowing to all the places that
which is exactly blood. What I do before I sit every morning.
Right.
Yeah, I wake up stiff
yeah.
and I do a little yoga yeah. before I sit.
So from this, we get a lot of stretching kind of mm-hmm. things. And so there's sculptures of folks doing that. And the other is balance poses come on pretty early as, again, sort of representing focus. So there's a very, very famous sculpture in South India of somebody balanced on one leg. And the idea is he did this for thousands of years in order to call down the Ganges River, right? And then there, it's very, very cute. There's a cat also balanced on one foot who's supposed to be making fun of the guy who's so there's balance and there's what I would call basic flexibility and stability kind of poses. And then really it's late 19th, early 20th century. You get a lot of the standing poses. Some of them are adopted from a practice called Surya Namaskar, which is like worship of the sun. And so you get what's called the cycle of the sun salutation cycle from that. And down dog is part of that. Mm-hmm. All of the warrior poses, triangle pose, a lot of the very, very famous standing poses are probably not very old.
So early 1900s.
Yeah. Okay. And some of it develops as a reaction to Western physical culture and Danish gymnastics stuff and calisthenics and, as a way of sort of asserting that Indian bodies are also strong and powerful in the face sure. of colonization.
Okay. I mean, which is very much how Tai Chi was popularized as a national exercise.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, well, the YMCA was in India and it's the Young Men's Christian Association at that point. And they're like, well, what about Hindu men? You know, aren't they cool too? And so, so yoga kind of gets synthesized as far as we know, from a variety of different sources. And then by the mid-20th century, it's being taught to Westerners by prominent Indian teachers. And I don't know. I sort of joke with my students that religion or anything else that comes to America ultimately winds up hybridizing with capitalism, which is it's sort of our state philosophy, right? And so what we get – what I would say yoga in 2025 is a combination of some things that are pretty old and some things that are not very old at all and some things that are extremely modern. Yeah. You know, the idea that you need a special outfit to do yoga would be very surprising to anybody from, you know, 1920, who they were just out there in loincloths doing their stuff and they didn't need a mat and they didn't need – color coordination.
As any cultural practice that migrates,
it
then is mixed with the culture mm-hmm. that it migrates to. And, and I mean, right, that's how you get Chan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, right? It's kind of that, you know, Buddhism going from India into mm-hmm. China and mixing with Taoism. And
it has to be relevant to the people it's addressing, right?
Yeah.
And then what's happened to sort of complicate things even further is that then the Western style yoga has now been re-imported to India and is being taught in gyms and things, which would not have been the historical situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's definitely like a parallel history there with Taoism and Tai Chi in that people will talk about Tai Chi as being thousands of years old, which the philosophical concept is because Taoism is, but the practice as a movement art and self-defense emerges really like 1600s roughly in Chen Village. And it's really kind of early 1900s that it actually starts to get called Tai Chi and look more like a lot of what we see today and then gets taught as a national exercise more than a martial art and more than a spiritual practice. Those are de-emphasized by the by the government essentially, right? And then of course it's introduced into the West, right? And now it's mainly taught in like elderly communities to reduce falling because it's really good for balance,
right?
right? And so, which is a wonderful benefit.
It's a wonderful benefit. It is not enlightenment. Right. Yeah. And so, yeah, it's very, very similar.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's this discussion going on right now in the American yoga community about sort of decolonizing yoga. And it's very, very complicated because Indian and Western physical practices are so intertwined. I mean, there's a limited number of shapes that the human body can make.
Yeah.
And so who invented the split? Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's a dead end in terms of a conversation. That said, again, you sort of cite your sources, right, and say some of this comes from India. Honestly, some of it doesn't. And so how aware are people of the different strands of this? It's tricky. So.
Yeah, there's national politics enters into that.
Yeah.
I mean, again, the history of karate and kung fu, and karate comes from Okinawa, which is heavily based in southern Chinese kung fu.
Right.
Migrates to mainland Japan, where it really mingles with kind of samurai-esque ideals, and the forms change.
Right.
And then from there to Korea.
Right.
And, you know, you're not going to study the art of your oppressor. And so then it's claimed to be an indigenous Korean art instead of a Japanese art that's an Okinawan art that's based in a Chinese, other Chinese art. Right. Yeah. And so, and they're all valid and they're all different, but there is a lineage there. Yeah. Which,
I don't know.
How you can't untangle that thread.
Yeah. The current prime minister of India, Narendra Modi, declared International Yoga Day about, I'm going to guess, around 7 years ago. And led a demonstration of yogic postures in the big central square in New Delhi. Yeah. Thousands of people with color-coordinated outfits and yoga mats.
Nice.
And he was out there all in white with a scarf in the Indian flag colors. And he said, yoga is India's gift to the world. Nice. And it was really very much laden with religious nationalism in the Indian context. Mm-hmm. And so what's perceived in India as a sort of right-wing Hindu nationalist thing in the United States is read as a sort of liberal global thing. It's the same postures, but you're just being read through very, very different lenses.
Yeah, and the Shaolin tradition in China is Buddhist, mm-hmm. and has been persecuted within China at different points because it's foreign.
Right.
Right, and that's why Tai Chi was chosen as the national exercise and not Shaolin tradition. So, yeah, the way politics mixes with these things.
And I will say on the American end of things, there's suspicion on the part of some folks of yoga in particular, but meditation also as foreign,
yes,
and therefore dangerous.
Right. And if I'm a Christian, I can't study that, right? Because it makes work for idle hands.
And why would you want to quiet your mind when that's sort of antithetical to Christian ideas of what the mind does?
So on that, we're almost out of time, but for someone who was starting completely from scratch, mm-hmm. with no experience, where would you recommend, whether it's about yoga or mindfulness, mm-hmm. or meditation, like where does a complete newbie?
I would say you could do a lot worse than YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's free. And just if you're looking at postural yoga, I mean, Yoga with Adrienne is popular for a reason. She's a good teacher. It's solid. Right.
I'm a fan. I'm totally a fan.
Jon Kabat-Zinn actually has some lead meditations on YouTube that you can check out sort of from the source, and give some great talks. Thich Nhat Hanh from the Zen tradition also has some great lead talks. There's I haven't used Headspace or any of those apps, but I hear good things about them. And maybe that's just entry level and you move on to something else. And maybe that works for you and that's what you use. And different people are going to want different things. So I would say number one is sort of, if this doesn't work for you, just try something else, because there's such a variety of practices out there.
So with that in mind, friends, your challenge this week is to explore different mindfulness, meditation, or yogic approaches. Try something if you don't already have something. If you have something and maybe fell off practice, maybe try to work it back. Again, as Susan said, a number of YouTube apps, more or less secular approach. Find the thing that you work. And I think you brought something else that's really important, that play, of playing with it and seeing what works. We'll link some of the apps and things on the show notes.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention that we did two episodes about the research around mostly mindfulness, but meditation and mindfulness, because it's certainly very much been adopted in kind of, you know, cognitive behavior therapy and lots of psychology research and medical research. And the two episodes we did, I would highly recommend.
super huge. Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much.
Yes.
It's been a pleasure.
Always thank good you. To have you and chat with you. So that's it for this episode. Subscribe to Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we'll be sure to respond. And make sure you follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have any questions, you can reach us at thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on, Susan.
Thrive on, friends.
Thrive on.